The big numbers are $1.6 trillion in student loan debt. It's bigger than credit card debt. It's bigger than auto debt. Close to about 10% of people are defaulting on their student loans. You really have people all across the economic spectrum now taking on student loans.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Aaron Smith is a co-founder of Savvy. Savvy is a new social impact software as a service company in Washington, D.C. that's working to solve the student debt crisis by providing technology to help student loan borrowers better understand their debt, lower their payments, and enroll in a plan to help them. Savvy works with all types of partners, from companies to membership organizations to financial institutions, to provide the Savvy tools to their networks. Before Savvy, Aaron co-founded and served as the original executive director of Young Invincibles, a youth advocacy and policy nonprofit, which he started while still a student at Georgetown Law School. There are over $1 trillion in student loans. Aaron and I had a good discussion of the politics around that key issue and the entrepreneurship involved in building a tool to simplify things. He is well worth your listen. So, after a quick word with our sponsor, my interview with Aaron Smith and Savvy.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from Timeplots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. Timeplots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Hi, Aaron.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Would you mind introducing yourself and giving me a quick biography?
My name's Aaron Smith. I'm the co-founder of Savvy. We're a social impact company trying to help solve student debt issue. Before that, I had went to Georgetown Law School, and coming out, I founded a nonprofit called Young Invincibles, which was a youth advocacy and organizing group that focused on advocating for issues that would expand opportunity for young people, starting out around healthcare, doing more work around higher education, youth jobs, youth voting, the whole sort of civic engagement for the 18 to 34-year-old cohort. And then I launched Savvy after that.
Most people coming out of law school don't launch nonprofits in the civic engagement area. What drove that?
My friends and I had been very involved in the 08 Obama effort. And so we had led the Georgetown Law School group on campus that was sending hundreds of volunteers down to Virginia to knock on doors for Obama. You know, it was obviously an incredibly exciting time. And the next year, 2009 rolls around, now he's in office and it's like, okay, now it's time to actually get stuff done. And we felt like a lot of the people, particularly the young people that we had worked with, were, you know, just a little more on the sidelines. And you had a big debate around healthcare reform that was going to impact everyone. And yet this huge sort of force and grassroots was not being directly engaged. And so we launched Young Invincibles very sort of simply to get our generation more involved on that sort of signature issue, which I think sometimes people think, oh, healthcare, young people don't really care about that. But actually, you know, young adults were the largest group of uninsured in the country. Many of us, myself included, had experiences of being uninsured after we, you know, graduated from school or, you know, had employers who don't offer benefits and all that fun stuff. So it was a very personal issue to a lot of us. And, you know, that's how we got started. And we, you know, really got started as a volunteer organization. And it was only after about a year of it that I was graduating that some of my friends and I said, you know, this is pretty interesting. Maybe we should make this a full-time job and, you know, rather than going the traditional sort of legal route, ended up starting this nonprofit.
Is that still around?
Yeah. No, Young Invincibles is going strong and has continued to grow as over 40 staff now. We launched offices in California, Denver, New York, Houston, Texas, Chicago, to do basically the same kind of work we were doing, advocating for our generation at DC, but also at the state level. And so that's continued to go strong. We have an awesome new executive director, and it's been great to see that it sort of continued.
Why'd you call it Young Invincibles?
You know, it's actually my sister's idea to call it that, but it was a term that the health insurance industry used to explain why young people were uninsured. So it's not that our jobs don't pay enough or we don't get benefits or health insurance is too expensive. It's that young people think that they're invincible, so they're not going to buy it. And so we sort of tried to flip that idea on its head and say, you know, actually, no, young people do want health care. And then it became a nice term because it can be applied to sort of anything. And we, after Obamacare passed, and we continued to do a lot of work on that, we started taking on other issues sort of that were relevant to that 18 to 34-year-old demographic, and higher education, student loan debt was sort of an obvious one. But also we did a lot of work on youth unemployment and youth voting.
Anytime you start something like Young Invincibles, you learn a lot, I think, about entrepreneurship, nonprofit or for-profit.
Yeah,
doesn't
exactly.
really matter. What did you learn?
I think that the people that you're working with is basically everything. I mean, that's what determines the success. I was very fortunate. We had an amazing group of co-founders who started Young Invincibles.
How many?
There were six of us. And we all, you know, played different roles, and that sort of evolved over time. And then, but even our initial sort of staff, again, were people that were amazingly smart and rose through the ranks to become leaders of Young Invincibles also. So it was, you know, I was working with my friends almost the entire time, and then we grew. And it's very similar with Savvy. I've been able to, my co-founder is someone who I got to know through Young Invincibles, and that's probably the biggest thing. And then there's a lot of tactical things, like, you know, Young Invincibles was fiscally sponsored at first, and that makes a huge difference for a lot of sort of startups in this space, because you're worrying about your like IRS tax determination letter. You've never done, you know, accounting before. And it's just sort of all these systems that you can piggyback off of a larger entity. So that was helpful. I was able to take some of those lessons to Savvy.
What was your role? And were you?
I was the executive director of Young Invincibles for a long time. And then we launched a consulting arm that was looking to work with partners who were trying to better engage young people, like the state of California. Then I ran that, and our deputy director at the time became the executive director. So I did that for a couple of years, and then I launched Savvy.
Would I be right in guessing that something that happened with Young Invincibles led you to Savvy?
I had my own student loan debt coming out of law school, like almost all of my peers. I had my own experiences, you know, having to fax my documents to the servicer, and no one has a fax machine, or missing my deadline for income-based repayment recertification, messing up my public service loan forgiveness forms, like literally all the things you hear about. I was, you know, a highly informed person who was making these mistakes. So I had my own personal experience. And then, you know, we had the experience of working with an administration that was very strong on this issue and well-intentioned in many ways, and still seeing the challenges. And so, like, we were at the table in Young Invincibles helping to write regulations on some of these income-based repayment plans, or helping to write regulations on the public service loan forgiveness. And still, even with that, these programs are incredibly complicated. So many people don't take advantage of them. In some ways, what happened, I think, with the past administration is you needed broader structural change to higher education to really get at these problems. Like, you can only accomplish so much through regulation. It was hard in that environment to pass big changes to higher ed. It's even harder now with this Congress. Coming out of that, I saw, oh, you know, we can do a lot. I totally believe we need to make huge improvements on higher ed. But we also have 45 million people who have student loan debt and need to navigate that right now. And what are we doing for them? So that was sort of the idea behind Savvy.
You referred to the student debt issue. Now you're talking about 45 million people impacted. That's a big portion of the country. What is the big problem?
The big numbers are $1.6 trillion in student loan debt. It's bigger than credit card debt. It's bigger than auto debt. Close to about 10% of people are defaulting on their student loans. You really have people all across the economic spectrum now taking on student loans. The people who are most at risk of default are not the people you hear about with the $200,000 in debt. It's the person who went to a for-profit school who has $10,000 in loans and does not have an income to support paying that back and has trouble navigating the system. So you got people on that end. You've got people, some of my law school classmates who left with $200,000 in debt and up and have their own sort of set of challenges. And it's sort of everyone in the middle. It's an interesting issue that touches literally every part of American society now. You could say the biggest driver is just the cost of college. The cost of college has gone up faster than healthcare costs have gone up, totally out of whack with what you would expect. And the reality is that if people want to pay for their kids to go to college, they see this as a necessary investment. The broader policy issue there is like we used to have government really subsidize public higher. You put aside the like
the state the Harvards schools used of the to world, be paid for.
The state universities, you could go and get a very affordable, like my parents went to in the SUNY system in New York, you could get a very affordable education, you know, work over the summer and pay for your tuition kind of thing. And now that's been flipped on its head. A lot of the state schools have become very expensive, you know, and then you got the private schools, which are just going crazy. And so it sort of starts with that state disinvestment. And some of the states are making strides in the opposite direction now. So you hear more push for free college. Tennessee did free community college. New York did a free college. And there's a lot of like nuance to what's a good program and not. Like you want to cover not just tuition but other costs, 'cause a lot of the costs of going to school are housing and books and all these other expenses. But there's real movement around making college more affordable. So that in the long term is going to reduce debt, or at least the growth of the debt. Then you've got the issue of what do you do with the 45 million people who already have all this debt. It's a fascinating topic for sure.
I assume that you've spent a fair amount of time learning about the whole college debt problem, right?
Oh, yeah.
What are the best sources of information about that now? Like, where do you go?
Yeah. I mean, the Department of Education puts out regular reports on its student loan portfolio. I mean, you can think about the Department of Education as one of the largest banks in the country. It's essentially, you know, has over $1 trillion in assets in this one area. And it releases regular reports that show like, you know, this is how much of that debt is in default. This is, you know, how many people. This is the average. So that's a great source of information. And then there's a lot of think tanks out there, whether it's Young Invincibles, who puts out really interesting research, to Pew, to Center for American Progress, to Century Foundation. There's all kinds of people sort of addressing the issue in different ways.
What's been happening under the current administration? Is there any changes since Trump came in?
About what you'd expect, they've gutted the major regulatory agencies that focus on higher education student loans. So like the CFPB has essentially been gutted. They were very interested in student loans, and that's, you know, gone away. The Department of Education has been much less interested in going after the servicers that do a poor job. They also, you know, are not interested in going after the for-profit schools that were defrauding people. So that regulatory interest has shifted really from the federal government more to the states. So there are some states who are very interested in this issue as well. The good news is that Trump can sort of say what he wants, but he's not going to pass anything through Congress. And so, for example, Trump had proposed eliminating public service loan forgiveness, and Congress has basically just ignored him. While we need huge changes to improve the system, the legal landscape has sort of maintained the status quo. It is still the law of the land. The Trump administration still has to follow the law or risk getting sued when it comes to programs like public service loan forgiveness. And that's, you know, what we tell people who are frustrated. Yes, it's a complicated system, but at the end of the day, it's like any other law, you know, they're going to comply with it. It may be very technical, but it is the law.
You're following the candidates in the current race. And a lot of them are talking about student loans in different ways. What are you hearing there?
I probably don't follow it as much as I used to, but it really runs the gamut on the Democratic side, from the Bernie Sanders sort of forgive all student loan debt to Elizabeth Warren, who also has a big forgiveness proposal, to, you know, much more moderate sort of positions. Like I've heard, for example, Pete Buttigieg talk about like expanding public service loan forgiveness and sort of everything in between. I've taken the position that like it would be in the best interest of the country if we forgave a large portion of the student loan debt. Warren's proposal, for example, looks at income. So someone who makes under $50,000, forgive their debt. Someone who makes over $250,000 probably don't need to forgive their debt, even if they have a lot of debt. You know, and there's some smart way to do that. I think something like that would help millions of people. Basically take this huge burden off the backs of people who are just struggling, and the government actually has the power to do it because they hold the debt.
What percentage of the student loan debt do they hold? Is
more 90%.
Than 90%. Is it
90%? 90%, yes. Yeah. There's 10% still private student loans, mm-hmm. but the vast majority is still government owned.
So it's basically a question of another trillion on the national debt.
So this is, you know, I think more of the question is, I actually think a lot of the Democrats would have good proposals. It's how do you prioritize spending on that versus spending on universal child care or, you know, the Green New Deal and a million other things that I think are great. That'll be the interesting thing. And, you know, as we saw in the Obama administration, it was a huge lift to get Obamacare done. And so I am hopeful that they will be able to do many things. but I think that's where it comes down to it. And as you look at the cost, it is, you know, can be expensive. But I would argue that in terms of bang for your buck, like in terms of middle class relief, it'd be like middle class tax relief, really, you know,
highly targeted
all of a sudden. Because you think about it, the average person is spending $300 a month on their student loan. So you take that burden off, it's, you know, that's a huge amount for people.
I bet you that some significant portion of the tuition raises that these colleges, particularly private colleges, have done have been because of the availability of loans to hike their prices.
This is a frequent debate in higher ed circles. The evidence is not clear that is what is happening. I think there's more evidence on the graduate school side. A lot of the six-figure numbers you're seeing in debt is coming about because people feel like they have to go to graduate school now, and the costs for graduate schools are just like climbing through the roof.
Particularly the professional schools.
Yeah,
right?
You know, your master's and this.
Your MBA.
Many places teachers are now required to have master's, and you know, these professional degrees that you feel like you almost have to have that now cost $40,000 a year. On the undergrad side, like even I think most students still go to public universities. So anything that's driving student loan debt and tuition is largely driven by like what the state investment is or not.
And but, states have systematically deinvested.
Yeah. So I saw a stat that, you know, University of Texas at Austin used to be the tuition was 90% covered by the state and 10% by the student and their family, and now it's reversed. 90% is covered by the student and their family, 10% is covered by the state. It's like hardly even public anymore. And so we've seen that in many states. So ultimately, that's the number one driver. You're also seeing, if you look at this huge growth in these people with these six-figure debts and up hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt.
So you see this landscape and you decide to start a company. What's the founding story there?
It was something that I thought that there was a real urgency around because people are living with this problem like right now. And it was something I was sort of intimately familiar with. And so, you know, we started out like many sort of startups by sort of testing the concept, doing small scale pilots, building our sort of like MVP of our product.
Say what the product what was the supposed product to be do? What were you
leading
to?
Yeah, you can think of it as almost like a TurboTax for your student loans. So you come to the tool, you enter information, you sync your loans, and it gives you a range of options, largely around the government programs. And so, you know, there's a number of different income-based repayment programs. Like, which one do I do? Repay, pay, IBR, ICR, you know, maybe some you're not eligible for, some you are eligible for. So we do a lot of that work for you on the back end and then give you your options. We also help people with the enrollment process. So that's why we compared it to TurboTax, like that full sort of like comprehensive experience. Because what we saw was it's not enough just to calculate the options if you're not also helping people navigate through the process. So that was the idea. And, you know, we've been able to find a lot of traction. Our average person saves, you know, over $1,500 a year by reducing that monthly payment.
What do they pay to you?
Usually the way it works is we operate almost solely through partners. So an employer would offer it to their employees as a benefit. So like the employer would cover the cost in that circumstance. In some situations, we'll have a premium service. So you can walk through and see all your options for free. But then if you want the premium level of service, so help with the enrollment, one-on-one support, ongoing monitoring, then you'd pay a premium fee, kind of like, again, like a TurboTax kind of model. So that's how it works.
How did that first, I don't know, year of the company go? Like, did you have to raise money? Did you start?
Yeah, and we were able to, just similar to starting a nonprofit, like we went to friends and family and said, hey, we've got this idea. Here's a PowerPoint presentation that walks you through it. And we were able to raise money from largely folks that we knew in the space and just get started and be able to sort of build the basic platform. And we made an intentional decision. We were not going directly to consumer, that we were going to try to work through partners. And we found pretty quickly that this was something that partners were excited about. A lot of them know that student loan debt is a huge issue, but they're not doing anything on it. And so this is a way to address that.
So who were some of the early partners that you worked with?
Ranges from like the NEA, the teacher union, to a local accounting firm. For anyone who had a base that had student loans and we could sort of work with them. You know, one of the things that's been interesting is we've seen such a variety of people. So like we work with Comcast employees, for example, who some of whom are call center workers who make $10 an hour and have $30,000 in student loan debt that they got a degree that maybe they didn't finish or maybe it was from one of these, you know, bad schools. And now they're sitting on $30,000 in loan debt. They don't have enough income to really, you know. So what happens is some of them go into default. We work with people who get their wages garnished. So the government can take 15% of your paycheck.
So it's become this anchor in their life.
A total anchor. And, you know, it gets to the point with some of these companies where the borrowers say to us, you know, my best option might be to leave this job so the government can't take that 15% out of my paycheck.
Wouldn't they track you down to the next job?
Yeah, but there's a lag. You might get away with it for a little while before they find you. But the sad reality is that, you know, income-based repayment is supposed to be like student loan insurance, meaning if you don't make very much money, if you make under, let's say, $20,000 a year, your payment could be as low as $0. So people should never fall into default. They should go into these programs, but people don't know about these programs. The servicers are not set up to help them get into these programs. And then once you do go into default or wage garnishment, your options become even more limited. You can't just say, oh, man, my wages are getting garnished. I wish I could go into income-based repayment. The government doesn't let you do that. Now you have to go through a whole loan rehabilitation process before you can get back to that point.
That sounds dreadful.
So, yeah, we got those kind of folks to the, you know, the teacher who's, like I said, had to go back and get their master's, and now they're navigating this, but they also are eligible for some of these forgiveness programs, which, you know, are complicated and they're frustrating. we're targeted at the sort of middle and working class kind of constituency, which we feel has been underserved. So like, you know, you probably heard of these companies like these refi companies like SoFi and others. Their prime target is the doctors, the lawyers, the business people who have like their average income might be over $170,000. So they're a very good bet investment from those kind of guys. Those refi folks are not generally interested in sort of that middle income group, and that's sort of where we see a lot of opportunity.
What was the sort of adoption like of this? How many people early on start to use it? How did you get seen out there, and how's it going?
Well, at the beginning, it was sort of intentionally we limited the pool because we wanted to really get feedback and see if the tool was
still working on the tool.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, maybe in the first year we had a few hundred people who came through the tool, and, you know, we were seeing pretty quickly that the savings would be substantial. You know, we also were seeing things about ways we could improve the tool and streamline the process and all that. I mean, now we have over 10,000 people who've used, you know, our tool, and growing quickly. And
so 10,000 people out of 55 million. Did you say
45 million?
45 million.
A lot of room to grow. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're still in startup, but the whole idea is like once you prove the concept, it should continue to accelerate.
Do you have competition?
There are not exactly like us. There's these refi folks who sort of dominate the airwaves. Like you'll see their signs on buses. You'll see them
I've heard them on the radio.
You heard them on the radio, yeah. Like that kind of stuff. There's another kind of benefit that is like an employer contribution. So some companies are starting to do this where they say, hey, I'll pay $100 a month toward your student loans as an added benefit. The challenge with that benefit is it's not like putting it to your 401k. It's a taxable benefit. It's just income. The employer is calling it something else. Until they change the law, they're proposing changing the law, that benefit will be limited to some companies that have the money to do that kind of thing.
Why are you only, if this is true, working through partners rather than put up your own ads on the internet?
There's so much demand.
Is it just because of a different business model? You don't want to charge people directly or what?
No, I think it's more – I mean there's a trust factor. I think if you're working with an employer or a membership organization that people know and trust, I think that helps to break through sometimes with people. There's a lot of distrust out there about these companies and like are
you – But don't
you
want
know,
to
scam?
Serve as many people as possible? Like
we'll get there. We'll get there. I mean we're still very young. I think that – there is a direct-to-consumer version of what we're doing that will come. That's sort of like phase two for us. This model was – this also from
a business – I mean, it feels like the government should offer this.
Yes.
They should just adopt this.
Yes, the government should just do what we're doing. Yes.
Or just use your software to do it.
Or they could – yeah. I would be open to it. I mean the thing is that there are certain things we know the government will never be that good at.
Well, it's not that good at building software.
It's not that good at building software.
But why not like go to the state of California or some progressive state and say –
What's interesting is we're starting to see cities particularly who want to address student loan for their population. Like we're talking to the city of San Francisco. We're talking to the city of New York. We're talking Miami. They want to do something for their population on student loans. And so we're actually talking to them about this exact idea. You know, license us to be this – this is a student loan education for your entire population. That's how we can start to reach like masses of people.
Do you think that
has a lot of potential.
Is your software now in shape where it could scale if it's suddenly – because I've built software and there's a difference between 10,000 people using something and a million people using something.
Totally.
It's a huge difference.
Yeah. No, our software is built to scale very seamlessly from that perspective. I think there's things that we want to do as the pool increases. So, for example, there's so many government programs, you know, like making the tools truly comprehensive. So there's a government program
and
they change all the time, right? Yeah. So like if you were a veteran, there's unique benefits. If you are a social worker in a distressed community, there's a unique benefit. Your teachers do unique benefit. There are state programs. There's like if you can get all this in one place, that becomes really powerful for the user. So I think there are some things, you know, that we can continue to sort of make our tool the most comprehensive that's out there.
Who have been good partners to you? I mean, I can imagine big anti-poverty nonprofits wanting to distribute what you have as part of a package of moving people up the ladder, or
the unions have been good, really good partners with us. Some of the advocacy groups, there's an advocacy group called Student Debt Crisis that has been a great advocate generally on student loans. It does a lot of student loan education. You know, that's sort of been the starting point, and that came a lot. I mean, the world that we were familiar with, people who wanted to figure out how to do more on student debt but needed something to help people right now. That's been a great starting point for us.
So how are you doing as a business? Are you profitable?
So there's some viewpoint in sort of like startup world that don't worry about revenue, you know, like
I don't buy that.
I don't buy that. Yeah, no, we are trying to build a sustainable business, and we're actually getting there. We're generating revenue. This is another reason why working with partners is a smart strategy, particularly for businesses that are starting out, because it provides a way to get revenue as you grow and grow your user base. Like the two go hand in hand. So we're in good shape.
Have you ever talked to like someone like Intuit, which does offer TurboTax, or one of these vendors that compete with them and say, look, this should be bundled in with what you've
got? We're starting to do that now. Yeah. I mean, large, those kind of like financial service type agent firms that are helping people with some other consumer problem, but like student loans is so technical and specific that they want someone else to offer that service. Like we work with a large firm that has financial advisors. And so their financial advisors are not experts on student loans. So now they can loop in Savvy as a platform, for example. There's a lot of potential there. There's a million channels. That's the thing, is there's a million channels and routes to reach people.
Yeah, it's often extremely tricky when you're a small business. How do you focus? What things do you decide to do with your time that have the most bang for the buck?
Yeah. And especially, I think, an issue as broad as this, where there's so many different angles that you can go, focusing in on, for example, on large channel partners that can get you to, you know, is important. Something that I've been excited about.
I think I saw that you're a B Corp. Is
yep,
that right?
We are.
Why?
I think that we started this very much with a social impact in mind, like that we were going to be – we have a unique background as advocates for student loan borrowers, and so we wanted that to come through sort of loud and clear. So, you know, just in terms of how we do our business and, you know, for example, like there's probably some folks out there who think that working with really distressed student loan borrowers, people who are in default, is not a good – but, you know, not a good business because like it takes more work to work with those folks. But that's been part of our sort of like mission and sort of from and vision from day one. And so I think the B Corp helps to capture some of that. And we've won some, like there was a social impact startup competition called New Media Ventures. We won that. And
you're one of the groups that they funded.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. How has that been helpful?
It's opened some doors to us, and I think in the progressive community, that is a nice sort of seal of approval. Yeah.
What did they get in return? Did they take a piece of the company?
They do it as an investment.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they do it as an investment, but that's not really what's driving it. I think it's really – they invest in both nonprofits and startups like us. Mm-hmm. So for the most part, I think that they have – investors who are in the progressive community who want to see innovative, progressive changes, whether it's technology that addresses an issue or a new approach to advocacy and organizing. They've funded all kinds of interesting groups.
Any of them you've become acquainted with and been helpful as sort of a peer?
We're kind of a unique one in their space. For example, they funded a place called Run for Something, which is like a startup that's helped to encourage lots of people to run for office, but just a sort of a huge array of things, mainly in the like political organizing space.
But you haven't found those people to be?
They're a slightly different world from us. You could call us like fintech. You know, most of them are not sort of fintech oriented.
Do they provide like an advisor or? I thought they had like an entrepreneur in residence or something.
Yeah, they do. And that's the kind of thing, like if we have a business question, like, oh, we're trying to connect to this investor, or like if we have this question about hiring or something. They're really helpful from that vantage point. And we're here in DC, you know, we have our background is here. So like sometimes the Silicon Valley world is sort of new to me. And so, you know, that's helpful in just sort of understanding, you know, that mindset.
Have you made yourself part of the DC entrepreneurial community in any way?
To some extent. My wife has a startup of her own, and she was much more involved in the local DC sort of startup scene. We are involved in one or two sort of formal startup communities in the DC area. We'll go to like a happy hour or talk or something like that. Everyone is so different in their focus. The ones that are the most helpful are the ones that are really sort of understand your space the most. Well, I mean, I'm curious from you, have there been any other startups that you've talked to? You know, like another company that sort of sometimes comes to mind with us is called Frank, which actually helps people navigate the FAFSA. Or there was a company called—
What's the FAFSA?
FAFSA is the federal application for financial aid. So like Pell grants, student loan. People fill it out when they're applying for financial aid.
Yeah.
Or another company called Pillar, which helps people navigate food stamps. So they've made this process of signing up and tracking and monitoring your food stamps much easier.
Right.
Like,
it
so
feels
how do
like
you,
there should be one big application that everybody can use.
Yes.
That helps them relate to their government.
Well, this is one of the things there was a lot of interest in this in Obama administration.
It's a big
thing. It's sort of
thing.
Like matching. So like – And we worked on the healthcare side. So if we sign you up for Obamacare and you get coverage based on your income, we should know right there in the spot, oh, by the way, you qualify for food stamps. Oh, by the way, your student loans are eligible for this program. It's all the same people. So to some extent, yes, you would think
you should have a profile
central
for the government. Under the government that spans all the programs. I'm sure people are leaving benefits and rights on the table all the time.
Oh, all over the place. Yeah. All over the place.
Maybe that's why we don't have one, because it would be expensive.
I think like people in government, most of them are well-intentioned. It's just like it takes political will and it takes a lot of leadership to like crash through the sort of administrative barriers to like getting the IRS to talk to Department of Ed, to talk to Health and Human Services. Like just getting the various agencies to talk to each other is difficult.
Given that you're sort of needing information from the government, has it been hard for you to obtain what you needed?
So we very intentionally, we obtain the information from the servicer. So not directly from the government.
So explain that.
Because so it's the government
servicer,
works.
So the government, you said the government holds most of these
the
loans.
Government holds the
well,
loans.
The
and
servicer?
Then they pay a contractor.
Is that a
Navient,
bank?
Fed Loan Servicing, Nelnet, Great Lakes. These are some of the big ones. Mm-hmm. These are private companies who get paid by the government to service these loans. So they make sure that you pay. So when I pay my loans every month, I pay to Fed Loan, you know, and this is a middleman.
Why does the government not do that?
It's a middleman.
But
I mean, there's folks who would argue the government should do it themselves.
Yeah.
Why does the government contract
Single
out a
servicer.
Lot of things? It's
yeah.
like they think that it will save them money, but it often
or
doesn't
they wanted
actually
to show
save
that
them
they
money.
Had fewer employees.
Exactly. And it's sort of like, oh, good. You know, we're being responsible, so we're cutting the number of federal employees. Well, you're just shifting the workforce off to this like these less accountable contractors.
Who get paid more money anyway.
Yeah. So they are middlemen. There's like, you know, about a dozen of these middlemen. And every once in a while, there's a proposal to revamp that system. But it has been hard to actually get through with that.
I'm sure. I'm sure they're lobbying against it too.
Yes. The biggest ones are very powerful and are good at lobbying. We mainly interact with them and get the information from them rather than from the—
So you have created this enterprise, which is your baby now, which is based in this system, which was pretty imperfect. Do you ever have a nightmare that the government solves the problem and like we talked about earlier, forgives all these loans and suddenly your business is— Shot.
I would love if Elizabeth Warren walks in and passes a bill to forgive these loans, I think it would be a good thing for the world. You know, I'm willing to sacrifice your small company on that altar. Yes, I'm willing to sacrifice it. Now, I think unfortunately, student loans are complicated enough that there's probably always going to be some room for people to help navigate it. But if you wanted to just wipe out balances, I think that would be good.
College or one of these proposals suddenly.
I think it would be great. Yeah. I think it would be a great thing. I would never want to be in a position where I was arguing against something that I thought was like that was good for the country and good for middle American people. And I've even thought about writing an op-ed, you know, saying like
– Put me out of business.
But, you know, I'm out of this business, but I want this kind of change to happen because it would help so many people. My biggest fear, you know, to get a little political is that they don't pick up enough seats in the Senate – and then we just have a stalemate.
Is there a question that I failed to ask that I should have?
I thought that was pretty good. I like to think that we are part of the broader progressive movement that I know that you focus on. Like people are tackling this from different angles and my own trajectory. Like, you know, there's obviously the federal policy and legislative work. There's the grassroots organizing work. And I think this is another sort of piece of the puzzle, which is like, how do we help people right now? And hopefully, I mean, this has always been an idea, is you get people engaged by helping them with something that's very direct and personal. And then they see, wow, this is great, but we need broader change to improve the whole system. So,
who's your co-founder?
Tobin Van Ostern. His background, so he had helped to run Students for Barack Obama in 2008. And then was over at Center for American Progress, where he was on the team that was involved helping to lead their youth organizing, helped to create some of the initial policy around student loan refinance, which is a proposal Warren supported. And then we teamed up at Young Invincibles to do technology work together. And then we started Savvy together.
How many people working for you right now?
We've got about a dozen people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really excited about the team that we have.
Well, it's an honor to talk to you today.
Yeah, my pleasure. Hope this was helpful.
Anything else you want to say?
I don't think so.
Okay, thank you.
So that was Aaron Smith and Savvy. Aaron is at buysavvy.com, BYSAVI.com. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com. Or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.